We are now resuming the interview with Julia Schuller. Please continue telling me about the whole snowballing effect of getting ready to go to America.
Right. So I would say it really started with imagining what it would be like to live in the United States. And so we started increasingly to listen to the radio from America, and especially to listen to people who came from America, okay, what they had to say, and to watch movies. Of course, most of the movies were American. So we watched very carefully. We watched the cars, we watched the clothes, we watched the apartments. I was very much impressed by how beautiful the waitresses were dressed, and just people who did ordinary work, like a sales girl and so on. So that, to me, seemed to be true, that was really quite a rich country.
So you're studying these films.
Oh, yes.
It's interesting.
Yes, they're watched very carefully. And so life went on. I was really very, very busy in school. I worked very hard. And, of course, the situation in Europe started to deteriorate. Okay, 1938 was the Anschluss with Austria. My mother had a younger sister who had left Russia in 1929 and married an Austrian and lived in Vienna. And at the occasion of the Anschluss, her husband sent her and her little boy out. And they left and had to cross the Alps on foot across the border to Switzerland. And she arrived unannounced in the middle of the night in Paris. I remember my aunt and my cousin arriving. We had a two-room apartment. This two-room apartment in Paris, at one time there were 7 or 8 people in it. I used to sleep on the floor months at a time. So my aunt came, my cousin came, eventually her husband came. And it wasn't just my aunt. There were many other people who came from Austria and people from Czechoslovakia and so on. And things really started to get from bad to worse. So in 1939, we had Chamberlain going to Munich. Okay. I must confess that I personally was very much relieved. I thought that he had done the right thing, that we were going to have peace and not war, but I was mistaken. I remember with this favorite aunt going to the movies and seeing in either at the end of 1938 or the beginning of 1939, the Wells, H.D. Wells movie. What was it called? The
Time
War
Machine?
Between
oh,
not
the War Between the
but
Worlds.
War Between the Worlds. War Between the Worlds. And we went into the movie, and as we came out, it was very eerie because, of course, the movie was full of sirens. And when we went out, we realized the sirens weren't in the movies. There were sirens in Paris. It was really eerie because at that time they were rehearsing the alarm systems, okay, for bomb alerts. And so we were issued gas masks and we had to go through these bomb alerts practice, okay? This was before the war actually happened, I believe. Well, then in the summer of 1939, we went up to the North Sea near Boulogne, the north of France, and we had a little guest. I had a British guest from England, an exchange student. I had spent the previous summer in England. So this young lady stayed with us, and we were about 16, going on 17. And I remember going with her to town. We were a little bit outside of the town, and people were all assembled in front of a store listening to the radio. And on the radio was Hitler. And that's how I heard the news of the invasion of Poland. And I believe this was the 1st of August, 1939, if I'm not mistaken. So my friend was extremely concerned. She was very, very upset. We rushed home. I can't remember if we had to take the bus or whether we were on a bicycle, how we got home. We got back to our house and she immediately sent a telegram and she demanded that I take her to the port so that she could sail home. She packed her bags. She went home the next morning. And so we all sat and everyone just waited to see what was happening. And of course, there was a general call to arms in France, which meant that from every corner of France, every single man who was in the reserves had to pack up and go to the post to be drawn into the army. And we immediately packed and went back to Paris. So then we didn't know what was going to happen. Okay, this was... no one knew what was going to happen. At that time, you felt the Germans were going to immediately start the Blitzkrieg. They were immediately going to start bombing and invade. And then, of course, nothing happened for 9 months, the phony war, okay? But what did happen is that instead of going back to my school in Paris, the high school, my mother told me that I was going to be evacuated and transferred to another school further south, to Angers, which is on the Loire, just to be on the safe side. Now, that's all she told me. It says, I understood that they were evacuating children from Paris because of the danger of the bomb alerts. So my mother went with me to Angers, and we found a French family where I could board because she had to go back to Paris. And that's where I spent the last year in France during the phony war.
You were there for a whole year?
The whole academic year, okay.
The academic year. Did you have any communication with your parents during that time?
Yes, of course. And of course, I should say that my brother had done his military service in the French army from 37 to 39. And then in 39, when he was going to be mustered out, the war started, he immediately had to join again. Okay, so my brother was in the French army in a motorcycle division, and he was immediately sent to the Maginot Line. Now, while he was in service in the summer of 39, I remember that my mother got a telegram that he had had an accident on a motorcycle. Very serious accident, had broken his back. And I remember my mother was in a terrible state. And she went to the hospital, and he was in a cast for 3 months. And miraculously, his spinal cord was not injured, and he recovered. He recovered so well that they just gave him a furlough, and he went right back into the army. So I was then in Angers. And, of course, those were hard times because no one knew what was going to happen during this phony war. And... things happened pretty fast, okay? We are getting to the period when the Germans crossed Belgium and invaded the north of France. We watched the news. Of course, we listened to the radio all the time. And within 3 days, and I can't remember the exact date, I really need to look it up. Was it the 15th of June that Paris was occupied? I'm not sure. But 3 days before the occupation of Paris, about 10 million Frenchmen hit the road from the north, from Alsace. And all these Frenchmen passed through the town of Angers so that the town was bought dry. That means there was nothing left in the stores. There was no gas left in the pump, in the gasoline tanks, okay, anywhere. And people just simply closed the town, that is that they closed the shutters. I remember we couldn't go to school because they used the gym for wounded. We had then trains that came from the front, and those were the only times that they really fought, okay, but they did have some wounded, and they used the gym for the wounded. That's the only time when I saw refugees. I mean, I saw people like a woman carrying a dead child, people on the road. So the town was invaded by all these thousands of people who then went out again, who hit the road in trucks and buses and by train, on foot, on bicycle or whatever. And after they had already left, suddenly my mother arrived on the last train from Paris that she had gotten onto, okay? was the last chance to leave Paris at a time when the Germans now were rounding up every political suspect person and every Jewish person and every alien. And of course, the French had put all the German and Austrian aliens into camps, which meant my uncle, for example, was Austrian, was now in a camp. Well, of course, she brought news of everyone who was rounded up and who was now in camp. And then I realized that if we had been in Paris, that would have been the end. Because, of course, we had known about the gas chambers very early on in 35. You know, it wasn't anything new. So my mother arrived in the afternoon, I guess, the third day when everything was empty. And I said, Mother, we are not going to stay here. No, that's the wrong sequence. The evening before she arrived at noon of that day, there was a knock on the door in this house, which was near the railroad tracks. And the lady of the house said, Julia, there's someone to see you. So I go to the door and there's a young man whom I knew quite well in Paris, on a bicycle, and he looked very white and very pale. He said, Julia, I have ridden my bicycle all the way to Paris, from Paris, and you can't stay here. You got to go with me. I can't leave you here because we don't know what's going to happen, and if they catch us, it's the end. So all I have to offer you is my bicycle. If you'll sit in front, you can go with me, and we'll just go south. And I looked at him and I said, well, that's very nice of you, but I'm not going with you on the bicycle. And he said, where are you going, Julia? And I said, I'm going to America. Okay, that's why I remember that now. You see, that's the first time that I said out loud and vocalized, I'm going to America. And I knew that that was the only issue, the only exit possible. And so he left. So then my mother came that afternoon, okay? And we had dinner about 6, and the sirens did not sound anymore. They just didn't bother sounding the sirens. But we could hear the planes, you know, and we were very adept at counting the time between the time that we heard the engine of the plane and the time that the bombs exploded. So we knew how much time we had. So at any rate, my mother said, let's go in the cellar, because we could hear these planes, and they were bombing the railroad tracks. And, of course, we were there eating dessert, and, you know, family dinners in France are really sacrosanct. You don't leave the dinner table. My mother literally had to push the family down the stairs. So we all were pushed down the stairs into the cellar, and then it sounded like that whole house was going to blow off, but it didn't. Just the windows blew out. And so we get up again, and my room was on the second floor, and of course the stairs were full of glass, and that's when I said to my mother, I'm not going to stay here. We're going to have to leave. And my mother said, how are we going to leave? I said, we're going to get a bike. So let's go up and pack, and we're going to go out and get a bike and just bicycle out. So we did that. I got my umbrella. I took my Latin-French dictionary for some reason. I took my notes. We had our papers, of course. My mother had a little money. And I packed my little bag. And then I said, let's go get a bicycle. Now it was almost dark. And we crossed the square in front of the house, which was very dangerous because it was full of holes. There were craters of a bomb or something. And then we crossed that square and went down the street. And I had no idea we were going to get a bicycle, huh? We're just going to take a bicycle. You know, when you have your back against the wall, you just do anything. So here I was searching for a bicycle and kind of looking into hallways or, you know, carriageways. And I can hear these voices of two ladies drifting toward me. And one voice says, I'm sorry, we just can't go. And the other lady says, why can't you go? And she says, I just can't go. Look, he walked all the way from the front, and his feet are just one bloody mess. There's no way we can go. So I walked toward these voices, and I said, excuse me, madame, but where is it that he can't go? And she said, well, we were going to go south. At 3 o'clock, the milk truck is going to stop here. And the milkman said he would take us and cross the bridge and go south. And I said to her, would you mind if we take your place, my mother and I? I said, help yourself. Just be here. So I said, Mom, that's what we're going to do. We're going to go walk back, and at 3, we're going to be here at 2:30 or whatever, and we're going to get on that truck. And that's exactly what we did. So we walked back, and we made sure we had everything, and that's what how we got out of Angers.
Where did you go to?
So, well, we didn't know where we were going. We just want to get out. We just want to get south. So we stood there at 2:30, and this was a little pickup truck, an open pickup truck, okay? And there were already people in it. They were sitting there like sardines, like there were 10 people sitting like this and 10 people there, and we all had our legs like that. So my mother and I just crawled up in there and sat down too. And so we crossed the bridge, or the bridges, because the Loire has about 3 arms there. And as we got to the bridge, there was a real scary moment because we saw some soldiers. And they were wearing some kind of gray uniforms. It didn't look like French uniforms to me. And of course, a soldier comes on to the driver, and here we are because, you know, as resident aliens, we needed to have a kind of a visa to go from one town to another, which we didn't have. So I was kind of scared, and I had told my mother, who spoke French but not very well, to please not open her mouth, not to say a word, okay? So there I sat very tense, and I heard the soldier tell the driver, okay, we give you 5 minutes, something like that, give you 5 minutes to cross the bridge before we exploded. So we crossed the bridge, and as we got on the other side, we could hear the watchtower on the entrance of the bridge going up into the air. It was quite a sight. And so everyone just breathed a sigh of relief and looked at each other. Some people lit up a cigarette, and we drove and all night. And the roads were already deserted because all these 10 million people had preceded us. But on the side of the roads, there were just lots of cars that had run out of gas or had had accidents and so on. So we got to Bordeaux. The next morning we got to Bordeaux. Of course, we had no idea what was going to happen. No one knew whether the Germans were going to stop, whether they were going to go all the way to Bordeaux or not. Before we left Angers, the last news we had heard was from the mayor of the town announcing that he was going to hand over the keys of the city at 4 in the morning. So you see, this is why it was absolutely essential that my mother and I left. Okay, we just made it before 4. So we got to Bordeaux, went to the railroad station, and that is when my mother sat down next to me. We sat on the floor with our little bags, and she proceeded to tell me about the Russian trains. And what it was exactly what happened in Dr. Zhivago. And I must say that many of my mother's experiences were very parallel to what you had in Dr. Zhivago, okay? And she didn't want to get on the train. She said, you know those trains in Russia, they were so crowded, you know, that people threw women and babies off the train. I don't want to get on that train. She didn't. Maybe she had hysterics. I don't know what happened. But I was 17, and here was my mother, who was such an authoritarian figure for me all my life. And suddenly the roles were reversed. I had to get on that train. I didn't care. And of course, the announcements over the loudspeaker came, please do not board the train. There are no trains going anywhere. Stay where you are. And I said, I don't care. The next train in that direction, we are getting on. I don't care how crowded it is. We are not going to stay here. And so when the next train came, which was after several hours, I just took my mother by her hand, and we just got on that train. And it was just like she had told me. That train was so crowded. People were hanging out the windows. They were sitting on the roof. It was so crowded that I had to stand on one foot. There wasn't enough room to put the other foot down. But on the train, it was like a release. Everyone started laughing, you know. People made jokes. It was, you know, the tension just suddenly gave way. And we were going from Bordeaux to Toulouse. I remember that train ride very well. So we got to Toulouse. And when we got to Toulouse, we got out of the train station, and I think the Central Market must have been not very far from the train station. And we found out that some of the other people of the group had preceded us. So there were a lot of our acquaintances already in Toulouse, okay? So we spent 3 months there in Toulouse, basically waiting for an American visa, this emergency visa.
Where was your father during all of this?
He also joined us in Toulouse.
Oh, so he was there.
Oh, yes, oh, well, he also.
And your brother
now,
too?
Either, and, okay, my brother was in the army, and okay, I should add that before we left Angers, that same afternoon when my mother had gotten there, we went to the post office to check if there was anything in general delivery. And there was a card from my brother addressed to me, which said, hospital train south, that's all. Hospital train south. I'm going on a hospital train south. So that's all we knew. So once we got to Toulouse, my mother systematically made the rounds of every military hospital, and she found my brother. So then he got out of the hospital and joined us. And then he joined us, and of course he was the big military hero. Now here's my brother with a French army outfit, with an arm in a sling, with a cane, you know, limping, very much the veteran. I mean, not only the veteran, but one of the few French soldiers who actually saw action on the Maginot Line and had been wounded, you know. And so he went with us, and we were apartment hunting. And of course Toulouse was run over with refugees, and Toulouse was a lovely little town with red roofs, and the people there had not had any kind of experience of the war. I mean, for them, the war was something on the radio and in the papers, and it was something that they experienced because there were so many displaced people from the northern part of France, okay? So they were not necessarily very kind to these refugees that were descending on them. And as a result of the Germans exporting all the food to the north and to Germany, there was a shortage of food in the city. I mean, there really was a very severe shortage of food. So we went room hunting. And finally we just answered ads, and we found this little room, and in the courtyard I saw a cage with two rabbits in it. And I told my mother, I said, "Mother, I don't care what that room is like. There are two rabbits in there. If there are two rabbits, we're not going to starve." And we took that room. It was a small room. It was about like this, smaller than that, where the doors, about like that maybe. And it had a little loft. So all four of us lived in that little room with the cage of rabbits. And those rabbits literally saved our lives, because we had rabbits too about 3 times during 3 months. Okay, it's about the only meat we ate in 3 months. I lost weight. I could afford to lose a little weight. And my job was to stand in line for potatoes every day. So we ate tomatoes and peaches for summer, which I love daily, but not every day, morning, noon, and night. And absolutely no milk, no coffee, no tea, no fat, no bacon, no meat of any kind, no eggs, no chicken, no fish.
You were lucky.
No butter.
What you had.
No sugar. You went to the store, and instead of advertising that they were selling, they had a whole list of things that they didn't have, you see.
In our last half an hour,
yeah,
because we have a half an hour left, why
okay,
don't you get yourself to America from Toulouse?
Okay, now I'll make the transition from this food that we didn't have. So, of course, I found all my friends, okay, all my friends, and we got together regularly, and you know what our pastime was? Our first meal in America. This became a tradition. We would meet and we would get together and we would chat, and so we would start this game, our first meal in America. And everyone had his turn at describing this first meal in America. And then the boys would literally fight. I mean, I was afraid they were going to kill each other, because one of them would say this kind of a sauce, and the other one would say, "No, you can't do that. You can't put this sauce on that kind of it." I mean, they were talking about imaginary meals, you see? So this is what we did. Every day we got together and talked about the first meal in America, what we were going to eat. And okay, that's a transition. And of course, we waited all the time to get these visas, okay? Because one of the women of the group was kind of a delegate, and I believe she knew Mrs. Roosevelt. I'm not sure just exactly of the political ins and outs. Anyway, they passed a bill in Congress to establish this emergency visa for political refugees. And so one day she came back from America. I remember a party because she wore a very elegant little black dress. You know the little black dress people wore then. And it had a zipper. That's the first time I saw a big zipper, a zipper in the back. And everyone had to go around. She made the rounds of the party. Everyone had to examine how the zipper zipped up and down. That was America for me, the zipper, okay? And so, I mean, just... So anyway, the announcement came that the visas were in, and so now we had to pack and go to Marseille to see the consul, American consul, and pick up our visas.
Did you do that en masse? Did everyone go?
I think almost everyone went. I remember I went with my family, my father, my mother, my brother. We all went to Marseille. We stayed in Marseille just long enough to pick up the visa. I can't remember if it was a week or 2 weeks. And then, of course, the difficulty was to arrange the trips through Spain and Portugal.
So you couldn't leave from Marseille?
No, no. We had to leave through Spain and Portugal. Now, my mother, my father, and myself, that was perfectly okay. We had our exit visas from France. We had an immigration visa, not immigration visa, the refugee visa to America. So our papers were perfectly in order. But my brother, he was in the French army. And so he had no permission to exit France. And so for him, this was very difficult, okay? And he went with us on the train from Marseille, but he had to jump the train before we got to the border and walk across. Now, they had a kind of a underground escape route through Spain for people in a similar position, okay? And so I don't think he went by himself. He went with a group of people, and there was a certain way to get across. I'm not sure how. But it took him a long time to get through Spain, okay? And it was very dangerous, because if they were caught, they would land in Franco's prison in Spain and eventually back to Germany. So that was kind of a little bit scary. But my father and my mother and I, we just took the train. And, of course, it took a long time, because the trains didn't connect, okay, all the way through Spain. Spain, to me, was as traumatic an experience as that train from Berlin to Paris. Because to me, these were the worst ruins I'd ever seen in my life. Spain literally was in ruins from the Civil War. Now, from the train, we stopped at stations where there was not a house standing. There was nothing but rubble. And the poverty was something indescribable to me. I'd never seen it. I saw children, you know, without legs, without arms, playing in the rubble. I saw people who were starving, literally starving. I remember in our compartment there was a pregnant woman who really was, she was a lady maybe in her 8th month. She was very ill and there wasn't any milk anywhere, she complained. Then, yes, food. Of course, we had prepared our food in Marseille. All of our friends had gone to literally scavenger hunts to get enough eggs together or bread together or something. So we ended up with a loaf of white bread, which was the first white bread I had seen in 3 months, because there wasn't any in Toulouse. We had this loaf of French white bread, and we had a couple of eggs. And I remember in the compartment, sitting with my mother, and we were getting ready to cut a piece of that white bread, and suddenly we see all these people in the door of the compartment staring at us. And I look up, and someone translates for me from Spanish and says they want to know what this is, where you got it. And I said, well, this is white bread from Marseille. And someone translated and said, you know, they haven't had any white bread in years. And I literally could not eat. I mean, that was my first meeting with Franco Spain. I couldn't eat. Because what could you do with this loaf of bread? If you divided it up, there would be this much for each person. I couldn't eat. And so this was it. Then every time we stopped, there was nothing but rubble. I mean, there was a sign of the name of the village and nothing there. Then we got to Barcelona eventually. There were people lying on the street who were too weak to get up. So we were in a hotel, we'd sit down for a cup of coffee, and you know, they would put a cube of sugar on the side. Each time that happened, there were maybe 20 little street urchins who were gathering around for that one lump of sugar. So I couldn't eat. I was really in a state of shock. And some of my other young friends, they had a fun time because, of course, the Spanish boys were very attractive and they danced. You know, after dinner, you went for a walk, you know, all over town. They had a great time. I couldn't. Now, I don't know whether that was my personality or what, but I just couldn't.
How long did you have to be in Spain?
It took over a week, maybe 8 days, because, as I said, each train did not connect with the next, so we always had to stay overnight. And I don't know why we had to stay in Barcelona a few days. And I remember in Barcelona, they advertised a visit of the prisons of all things. I mean, weird. I had people approach me, and someone asked me to put a stamp and mail a letter for him to America, and I didn't understand why. And then I saw him put the Franco stamp upside down on the letter, and he said, "Now you mail it." I can't. You know, things like that.
Did you go on to Lisbon?
Then we went to Lisbon. And so Lisbon was lit up, bright. It was peace. I mean, there was no war. And my mother, of course, being a physician, told everyone else, "Now look, be careful, don't overeat. Now, you have not eaten for 3 months. I mean, your stomachs are very small. You just take it easy. I mean, have some bouillon, have some soup." And of course, what did we all do? We ate. And for 1 week, everyone was sick like a dog. We all went around. We were sick, sick, sick. But we ate. It was glorious. So for 3 weeks, we stayed in Lisbon, and it was like a vacation. We stayed in a nice, lovely hotel. There were beautiful avenues. We went to the zoo. All we did is just hang around, you know, like young people do. And we talked about America, and we tried to practice our English, you see.
So it's in Lisbon you got the boat.
In Lisbon we got the boat, and it probably was the junkiest boat, but we weren't aware of it, okay? It was a boat that predated World War I, I think a Greek boat. I don't know if it was flying under the British flag or not, but we were escorted by German submarines, apparently. It was a very, very old boat, and we were in third class, which meant we were way down there, you know, like six bunks. It was a crowded boat. I mean, you had to walk over people's legs on the deck, but it was a fun boat. There were all these groups from every part of Europe, from Czechoslovakia, from Hungary, from Austria, from Germany, from Poland, from, you know, all these overrun countries. And each group was trying to learn as much English as they could. And each group was dancing and playing music and talking, and it was just marvelous. And we were on that boat for a long time. The regular crossing was maybe a week. We were on that boat much longer. I can't remember how much. And I must add this story because that's really fun. Among our group were two of our young friends who were pregnant, two young ladies. One of the young ladies' husband was with her, but the other young lady's friend had been recruited in the French army and had gotten lost, so she was by herself. But these two young ladies were due to deliver within the week, and it was absolutely paramount that these babies would be born American citizens. So they were not allowed to move. They were like 19 and 20 years old. They were literally carried. They were put in chaise longues. People carried food to them. It was like the whole ship adopted them when they're not allowed to move. I mean, those babies absolutely had to wait to be born in America, you see. I mean, this was the mood of the ship. And we also had a Christian Science lady who gave lessons in American English and then what to do on arrival in New York, who showed us a nickel and what to do with a nickel and how the subway worked and everything in New York. It was very, very good. It was well done. So everyone was very busy taking lessons, practicing English, dancing and playing music and discussing what they were going to do.
Talk about where you actually stayed in the boat. You said you were third class. Can you just describe what that
Well, yeah, it was a narrow, what would you call it, a gangway, just a narrow hall like that. And our cabin was maybe this big, and it had 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, bunks in it, I guess. And then we did, there were showers, you know, but we had to go down the hall, okay? And then I discovered they had marvelous pastry in first class. Someone told me about this marvelous pastry, and of course I like pastry. And I went to the kitchens once to ask for some of the pastry, and that was not a very, that was not the thing to do, I found out. But the deck, there was nothing on the deck. There were just some deck chairs. And as I said, it was very, very crowded. People would just sit very informally on the floor, you know. And of course, we didn't have very warm clothes. We had my mother in Toulouse, she had already shopped for remnants, you know, and things that she got, and she had made some clothes. I had two blouses, and I had a blue skirt, and I had another skirt, and I had some sandals. And maybe I even had a sweater, I'm not sure, but that's really just about it. We basically all had one change of clothes.
What month is it that you left?
Well, Lisbon, it was in October.
It was in October.
Okay. Was maybe the 1st of October, and we arrived the 12th, okay? So we left when it was beautiful in Lisbon, it was warm, the weather was ideal. I mean, just like here now, okay? And then we arrived, of course, we were all very excited, and we all run up on the deck, wrapped in our blankets. We really looked like refugees, wrapped in our bunk blankets, which were kind of a khaki sort of thing. And there was the Statue of Liberty that we sailed by, and there was Ellis Island. And then we got off the boat, and the first thing, there were tables, there was coats.
You got off the boat?
Right in front there.
Here
I remember Ellis Island.
Oh, describe, yeah. Tell me about Ellis Island then, because you ended up being here.
Yeah,
Ellis
right.
Island at
the boat must have docked here, because I kind of recognized the spaces. And before we went in there, I think they had tables with coats. Now, they had people from this organization meet us, okay? The same organization that had arranged for the visas and everything else.
Do you remember the name of the organization?
I'm sorry, I don't. Okay. So then, and they also gave us money, because otherwise we would be arrested as vagrants, okay? I think we got something like maybe each person got $5, so they wouldn't be arrested as vagrants. And my family got maybe $25 for the first month or something like that. But there were the tables with coats. I remember that because I was freezing. I mean, I was not about to go to New York wrapped in a blanket, okay? So I looked at the coats, and I remember I picked a green coat. A green winter coat. So I was warm enough. And then there was this thing about the restroom, and I couldn't find a towel to dry my hands. You know, in Europe, they always have these things where the towel winds down or something like that. And I looked around, and here were these ladies in fur coats. I mean, just like in the movies, okay? And I did learn some English. I had spent 2 summers in England, so I did, I mean, I didn't speak it as fluently as I do now, but I could communicate. So she explained to me how to push the button and dry my hands under this hot air. So that was my acquaintance with America, okay? The fur coat and the hot air dryer.
Were there lots of people at Ellis Island?
Yes, there were crowds and crowds, but it was pretty well organized, okay? Whoever met us must have taken care of the formalities, because we didn't spend very much time here, okay?
How long were you here for?
Maybe 2 hours altogether, 3 hours. It wasn't really very long.
I wanted to ask you a question earlier. What do you think is going through your father's mind through this whole immigration process? You know, what do you think?
Oh, my father was absolutely enthralled. He was the happiest person alive to come to America, because for my father, that had always been a dream, okay? Now, for him, the American dream was very real. And I must tell you that for me, the American dream is very real, too. And I can think of so many examples where people have realized the American dream, okay? And it meant freedom to do what you want. It really meant freedom. And I must say that our family really has found it. Oh, yes.
Tell me, you were just at Ellis Island for a little while.
Just right. And then immediately We were immediately taken to this hotel room that someone had the same outfit had reserved for us. And I thought it was like a palace. It was one of these old apartment houses along Riverside, about 100 Third Street or something like that. I can't remember. And of course, it had been converted. It was a big apartment that had been converted into basically a boarding house sort of thing. And I remember we had one room about like this, like a small room. That was just my mother and I, and my brother and my dad apparently had another one. And I remember how impressed I was. It had maple furniture, and the curtains and the bedspreads matched. Everything matched. And then the kitchen was a big kitchen, and there were maybe 8 different families in that one apartment. But in the kitchen, each family had half a cupboard to themselves. And with our $25, we went out and we bought matching dishes at the 5 and 10. And no rich dishes, because now they're antiques. People pay a lot of money for them. They came in different colors. I thought this was absolutely fantastic. And so we shopped for food, and we stocked our little cupboard. And, of course, we had to share our bath. And immediately everyone started looking for work.
Talk about something that was really hard to get used to about being in America for that first month or 2 months, whatever. Was there something that you had a hard time with? Or perhaps your mother or father, something that you...
Compared to their life in Paris and the war in Europe, I can't think of anything that was hard. Now, of course, you know, American democracy works wonderfully for people who come from the lower end of the scale, okay? Now, from people who come from the upper end of the scale, and who have been raised to think that they're a little bit special, it's very difficult, okay? So they would be considered snobs here, okay? But let's say that someone has been raised and they have, you know, 2 PhDs, they've written books, they're well-known people abroad, they're famous writers or actors or whatever, and they come here and they speak English badly, they don't really have a profession that they can use or apply, and they're being treated just like everyone else. Some of these people reacted badly. They couldn't really take that very well. You see, I would say that is maybe the only thing that some people, not necessarily my parents, had trouble with.
But perhaps some of their friends.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or my mother, for example, who spent most of her life being a physician, took jobs as an orderly, basically. She couldn't even get a job as a nurse because she did not have the papers for that, okay? But she had to work. She got a job doing an orderly's work, which was very difficult. The difference is that my dad, who had never worked with his hands in his life, my father was someone who literally didn't know how to boil an egg or fix a cup of tea. He got a job in a chemistry laboratory. I mean, just unreal, and he felt very proud because he earned money, honest money, and it was almost enough to eat, you know?
But your mother, of course...
My mother suffered because here she had to take orders from people that she considered very ignorant, okay? And she considered a lot that she saw in the hospitals was really pretty awful. She worked in the emergency room at Harlem Hospital. She worked in the emergency room down here downtown in New York, and the things that she saw are terrible. You know, we talk a lot now about what's happening in the underclass and so on. My mother saw that in the 40s. I remember coming home, see, it is just terrible. I see 12-year-old little girls who have been violated by their father and they're forced to have the baby. I mean, so I remember, I said, you know, we have drunks. I have all these people that are cut up. Those are all the kids, all the gunshot wounds. In Harlem Hospital, they had the police station right next door. But this was later on when she could already, she basically got a job, the equivalent of a residency, okay? But she suffered a great deal with that and having to take orders from people who made a lot of mistakes and treated people the way they shouldn't and things like that. She was very impressionable. So she had a hard time.
In our last few minutes, talk about you and talk about...
Me?
Yeah, and talk about how you adjusted to America. You obviously seem to be glad to be here.
Well, yes, but I didn't like New York. Remember, I was very homesick for Paris, and New York is not Paris. So my only thought when I got here was not only remember, I told my boyfriend I was going to America. And when I got to New York, I immediately realized this was not America. That if I stayed in New York, I would always be with my own friends. I would not speak English. I continue speaking German and French. I would be caught up in this society of exiles and immigrants. So my only way out was to go west. And this is exactly what I proceeded to do.
How long did it take you?
It took me 2 years because I tried to go to college here, but I was not a resident. Remember, we didn't come in on an immigration visa. We did not have resident status. So I was not eligible to go to a state university, okay? And besides, we didn't have any money. So I worked at all kinds of odd jobs.
What was the first job you got?
Oh, wait a minute. I had so many. I ushered in a theater once. Then I zipped zippers. I had to go all the way to Brooklyn on the subway from the Bronx every day I'm mixing that up with another job. I zipped zippers, but I did have to take the subway until all my 10 fingers were raw. I had all my 10 fingers bandaged because I had to pull them through a little zipper machine. Because, you know, they used the old zippers to make new zippers out of them because of the scarcity of metal during the war, okay?
So zippers really did mean America to you from the time.
Oh, yes, zipper. And I had to carry these big bags of zippers on the subway, okay, and was paid by the piece. I forgot. I earned like maybe 18 cents an hour, I don't know. Then I made leaves. I worked for a Polish artist who made very fancy little trees with birds sitting on them, ceramics. And my job was to make little leaves out of clay. Trays of leaves. I mean, little leaves. I made 60 leaves a minute, I think. 60 means I counted the leaves. And I figured that there was no future in making leaves. And the lady was very kind to me and said, Julia, I don't think you're going to make a career out of making leaves. Why don't you try to go to college or get another job? I was not very business-minded. So I quit making leaves, and I got another job as a volunteer at the American Jewish Congress being a file clerk. That was very interesting. So I had to learn how to type. I typed all the addresses, filed all the correspondence. It was very interesting. And I saw a lot of interesting people there. I worked there about 6 months, and I learned something about office procedures. I went out with the secretaries and so on. And at that time, I really spent all my time basically making applications to go to colleges. I sent out I don't know how many applications, and I got 3 in the mail. And I was accepted at the University of Oberlin, I think in Ohio, and the University in Montana, I forgot which one, and the University of Boulder in Colorado. And I looked at them and I said, Ohio is too close to the East Coast. That's not the real America. Montana is west. I don't have enough money to go all the way there. So I guess it's going to be Boulder, Colorado. So that's what I did. I went to Boulder, Colorado.
When you were in America the first couple of years, and actually extend this into when you went to college, did you ever find any prejudice against you because you were an immigrant?
In America?
In America.
No, that's what's the... that. Yes, I guess I did. I shouldn't say no. In New York, no. But I must say I was used to prejudice because in Germany, as I grew older, people would remark that I was not German. In France, the first few years, if I ever mentioned Berlin, little children would think I was German, literally spit at me. So I had to be very careful about keeping German and Germany under the lid. In America, yes, because when we were in Boulder and later in Iowa, I had trouble getting an apartment because I'd never lost my German accent. In Boulder, I looked kind of like I might be maybe South American, and people kind of looked at me a little bit as
I imagine
sometimes.
You were probably quite exotic.
Yes, very exotic, and I acted. So I did have trouble in that way. But this is one reason that I settled in New Orleans eventually, and I like New Orleans very much.
Which is a very sort of international
That's right,
city.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I have one final question for you. Now, we've been talking for 2 hours.
I know.
It's been splendid. And I have one final question for you. And that is, it's a two-part question.
Yeah.
The first part is, how do you think your life would have been different had you not come here?
I don't think that's a question that's applicable. The only question applicable would have been, how would my life have been different if my parents had not left Russia? Because there wasn't any choice after that, okay? the question isn't applicable because if I hadn't gotten out at the time I did, I would be dead. Well, everyone else who didn't go out would have been dead, okay, and I was very much aware of that. I mean, I'm basically a survivor.
Are you glad that you came here?
Of course. Yes, of course. Of course. I mean, I can't imagine any other choice. And of course, I did find my American. I married the most American guy imaginable with a German name and raised an American family.
So, when you look back on your life...
Yeah, right.
It was the right thing to do.
Oh, yes, of course.
Good.
Okay. Yeah.
I have to ask that question. So, well, I want to thank you very much. I'm glad that George was the name of the interpreter.
Yeah, right. Okay.
I'm very pleased that he brought you up here.
All right. Well, I hope it helps. I hope I haven't... Is this the end of the tape?
Yeah, we're going to be signing off in a second. We're not.
Oh, you mean this is still on the tape?
We're still recording. Yes. That's okay.
Okay.
Anyway, this is Paul Segrist signing off with Julia Schuller on June 18th, 1992.
Okay.